Bonjour, it is Wednesday, March 20th, and so happy, happy French Language Day. Grant Robertson is set to deliver his valedictory speech at Parliament this afternoon. I wonder if he'll do it in French to mark the occasion. Possibly not, but if you did want to listen to it or keep across his speech, stuff.co.nz will have you covered later today. Kia ora, this is Newsable. I'm Imogen, and this is what's worth talking about. It's the weight loss drug that we are still talking about more than a year on. We're talking all things Ozempic and what's happening with it here in New Zealand. Who is donating to our political parties? We're deep diving into some of the country's deepest pockets. Donald Trump Jr. was set to tour Australia, but why have the event been cancelled and tickets refunded? Plus, AI delivers its verdict on President Joe Biden's cognitive abilities. All that's coming up in a moment here on Newsable.
Newsable takes time and resources to produce. Please support our mahi and visit stuff.co.nz/support.
Ozempic, a drug typically used to treat type 2 diabetes, continues to make headlines globally as more and more social media influencers and celebrities turn to it to lose weight, leading to it being dubbed the Hollywood skinny jab. The medication burst onto the scene a year or so ago, and just recently it's seen Oprah Winfrey have to step down from her role on the board of Weight Watchers, which she'd held for close to a decade after she was revealed to have been using the drug. In the last week as well, CNN has reported the company behind Ozempic, Novo Nordisk, is now worth more than Tesla by a cool $40 billion. Dr. Luke Bradford is a Tauranga-based GP and is also the medical director of New Zealand's Royal College of GPs, and he's here to talk all things Ozempic. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Eva.
Is Ozempic even available in New Zealand at the moment?
No, it's not. So Ozempic is a drug called semaglutide, and we don't have that in New Zealand. But we do have two drugs which are really similar, liraglutide, and there's one called dulaglutide, really catchy name. So people know them by Saxenda, which is the one we use for weight loss. The other two tend to be for diabetes treatment.
It was approved by MedSafe last year, though, I believe. And was that purely for type 2 diabetes treatment, or is there scope for it to eventually be prescribed here as a weight loss drug?
No, I think it will eventually come as a weight loss drug. Like I said, Saxenda already is in the market for that. And so, no, I suspect it will arrive for weight loss.
Are you getting reports from GPs and even yourself getting patients requesting weight loss drugs?
Absolutely. And we've seen that real growth over the last 18 months or so. Obviously, the international press is marked on it. There's a lot of influencers out there who've had really good effects, and they do seem to work. And actually, the drug companies themselves were offering two-week trials for people to see if it was effective for them and if they could tolerate it, and we saw big uptake from that.
And is it readily being prescribed?
Semaglutide is Ozempic, whereas a liraglutide is the Saxenda. That's the one we're prescribing for weight loss, and it is being prescribed. I mean, the barrier really is cost. It is the recommended retail price is $499 a month.
Wow.
So that is up there. It is, like I said, it is funded for certain diabetics, but for weight loss, it's not funded. So that's the barrier, really.
And A, is it successful in aiding weight loss? And B, remind us how it aids weight loss.
Yeah, so they are successful. In fact, in the guidelines, it says to cease use if you haven't lost 5% of your body weight after 3 months of use. So people really are having good effects from it in terms of their weight loss. So it's a GLP-1 inhibitor, and GLP-1 is a hormone you release which tells you when you're full. So it makes you feel like you are full a lot of the time, so it decreases your appetite. It also decreases the speed with which your tummy empties, so that stays for a longer time without wanting to eat. And if you do eat, you're very full very quickly, and as a result, you take in less calories and therefore lose weight.
Are there criteria that people have to meet in order to be prescribed these weight loss drugs?
There absolutely should be, and that's one of the things that has popped up. So they're indicated, we call indications for medicines, they're indicated for a BMI of over 30 or a BMI of over 27 if you've got comorbidity, something alongside it, something like high blood pressure, diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, or marked dyslipidemia, which means your cholesterol's all over the place. But we do know that's not necessarily being stuck to at times.
Are there any side effects to taking these types of medications?
Yeah, absolutely. And any medicine can have side effects. And then, of course, not every side effect is for every patient. But certainly these medicines do. There's two things to say. There's the immediate side effects, ones we know about, and the risks that come from it. And then also, we don't have any longitudinal data. So we do not have the sort of post 5 years of what these things do or any risks for that. But in terms of side effects, by far and away, the most common is nausea, vomiting, and reflux. Of course, people who are prone to heartburn are likely to get that because their tummies are staying fuller for longer, more likely to get it. And some people really can't tolerate the medicine because of the nausea or the reflux can be really severe. Some people can get aspirations from that if they're laying down, eating at night, full tummy, and that can be quite dangerous because, of course, the tummy contents can go into the lungs. The most serious seems to be pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of the pancreas, and that is a genuinely serious illness.
Dr. Luke Bradford, thank you so much for taking the time to kōrero.
Pleasure.
We are about to climb into the ins and outs of political donations. And so to make sure you get the background details on stories like this one, make sure you're following us on TikTok or Instagram. Just search for us, NZ Stuff. And remember, if you want to share your thoughts on any of the stories we do or anything just in general, always interested to know what you're thinking. We'd love to hear from you. So send me an email, newsable@stuff.co.nz. Of all the details that come out after the elections, perhaps one of the most intriguing is the detail around political donations. Who has given how much and to whom? And these are the big ones that have to be declared. So far, details of anything over 30,000 have been released. Smaller amounts will come out later, and anything under $1,500 does not have to be reported publicly. Stuff political reporter Bridie Whitten is here now to give us all the details. Bridie, $13.4 million in donations between just two of the three coalition partners, National and ACT. That seems like a huge amount of money, is it?
Well, it is a lot of money for New Zealand's politics. The key issue is the widening imbalance between the left and the right. So Labour and the Greens didn't even come close to that. From big money donors, Labour got about $900,000. The amount that National and ACT are getting from those big money donors is quite staggering. Paula Bennett was sort of sent out to sort of drum up money from wealthy donors. She didn't want to talk about it, but she did raise about $1.8 million, wow, which is a staggering sum from individuals. From 24 big donors in 2022, National raised $2.3 million. So that is quite a lot of money from sort of one-off big donors.
Who are these big donors donating to the likes of National and ACT?
So you've got a sort of smorgasbord of people from the world of business and finance, property, a lot of real estate. For National, you've got wealthy philanthropists. You've got interesting characters for ACT, such as Murray Chandler, who's New Zealand's only chess grandmaster. Huh. Also with National and ACT, you've got Nick Mulgrave from Zuru. And you've got philanthropists like Brendan and Joe Lindsay. So Brendan Lindsay started Systema,
right,
which, you know, would be in most New Zealand households. And he sold that to an American company for millions upon millions. So it's people like that.
And do any strings come attached to these big donations?
Well, that's the sort of opaque part that is a bit harder to quantify either way. What is very clear is that these rich listers do get access to politicians that other New Zealanders do not have even a remote chance of getting.
You mentioned earlier about how much Labour or the left, for example, gets in political donations. Are there concerns at all from experts around the fairness of donations? I suppose it's technically not a party's fault that a supporter has more money that they're willing to give.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely not. Labour tends to get its money from the unions. But no, the Greens have gotten some money from rich listers too. You've got James Cameron, was a big donor, as was a knitwear company. It was also a big donor to the Greens, gave them $100,000. So it's just a bit of a reality of our political situation that parties need money to run. Mm. This is something they have to do. They have to drum up this cash. But the sort of fairness is that, you know, when there is this huge imbalance, that's when it becomes less fair because certain political views don't get the same airtime as others. But that's a sort of more of a broader, I guess, philosophical question that people have to grapple with, you know, because people on the right would say, well, of course big business want to come to us because we're going to have better laws for them. And we're often from big business ourselves and we share their values. So And the other thing is that donating to political parties is just a genuine political expression. So there's that element as well, sort of tempering, you know, people's ability to share their views and the way they want the country to go. Because the other thing was that a lot of the rich listers I spoke to, well, all of them actually, you know, said they care deeply about New Zealand. It's not this sort of, you know, murky backroom, transactional, I'm hoping to gain something, ha-ha attitude. They actually want New Zealand to be a certain way because they care.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did the independent electoral review that was released earlier this year touch on political donations at all?
Yes, they did. So they actually made quite radical calls. So they wanted to cap donations at $30,000, which would mean that you cannot donate more than $30,000 to a person or a political party. They also suggest taking away the anonymous level, bringing that much lower. So they recommended reducing the amount of money that can be donated anonymously from $1,500 to $500.
Stuff political reporter Bridie Whitten, thank you so much for your time. And you can read more about this. Bridie's got a piece on stuff.co.nz right now. It's a great read. Make sure you check it out. We have all the tea on the bizarre case of Donald Trump Jr.'s Australian tour coming up next. And remember, if you are enjoying what you're hearing, do chuck us a like and a follow on your favourite podcast platform, because it means you'll never miss a Newsable episode. Plus, while you're there, if you feel like it, why not leave us a review? I'd love to know your thoughts. The Trump family is once again in turmoil, with former President Donald Trump unable to secure $464 million US dollar bond he's been ordered to pay for his civil fraud case in New York relating to the misstating of his property values. This is an amount he must stump up in order to continue his appeal. But there's also trouble afoot with one of his sons. Donald Trump Jr. was set to head to Australia for a Down Under speaking tour, but Australian media is reporting the whole thing is on the verge of collapse, with delays and cancellations to the 2023 dates originally advertised. Tickets now are starting to be refunded. So here to bring us up to speed on what's happening across the ditch is Blake Antrobus, a reporter for News Corp Australia. Blake, thank you so much for being here. Blake, tell us about this tour. Were the dates and venues already confirmed?
So the long story short of this is basically that Donald Trump Jr., who's the eldest son of the former US president, was meant to come to Australia in mid-2023 and host speaking events across Queensland, New South Wales, and Victoria. Now, the actual locations were kept a bit under wraps because they were worried about violent Antifa thugs coming along, or along those lines of protesters. But it was being organised by Turning Point Australia, which is the Australian arm of a well-known conservative action group originating from the US. And Mr. Trump Jr. was going to be joined by Nigel Farage, the former UKIP leader, and Alex Antic, who's a Liberal senator for South Australia and a very big fan of Trump. And it was going to be discussing the usual thing of what they said, the disease of woke identity politics and cancel culture, you know, whatever that means, usually along the same lines as his usual rhetoric in books. And those tickets were priced anywhere between $89 to hundreds more for special packages. And there was a VIP ticket offer for about $2,500 Australian, where they'd offer front row seats, a pre-dinner show with Mr. Trump Jr., and even a champagne reception.
A show. I love that.
I love that too.
Wonder what that entailed. What was the reaction, Blake, when this tour was first announced from other members of the general public?
Look, it was actually met with pretty warm reception. There were thousands of people who were actually booking tickets to hear these speaking events, and everything seemed like it was going smoothly. There was controversy from people in Australia who weren't happy with Mr. Trump coming. Some urged the government not to give him a visa, but it doesn't seem like that really went anywhere. Everything was kind of meant to go ahead in July for the usual tour. But then that's when things start to get a little weird, because in early July, pretty much just ahead of the speaking events, the tour organisers said that they were actually pushing back dates to September because Mr. Trump Jr. was apparently having trouble securing a visa. But the federal government actually stepped in and said that really wasn't the case, because his visa application was the same as everyone else's. And it got to the point where the federal Home Affairs Minister, Claire O'Neill, was shooting off messages on Twitter, well, you know, now it's known as X, where she was calling him a big baby and a sore loser, and suggesting he was blaming the government for what she was calling poor ticket sales.
So have we been given any other reasons behind the postponements? I mean, it's now March. Is there any indication that there might be any date?
Well, look, it was pushed back initially to September, and that was a bit more of a vague reason, because it just seemed to be what the organizers were saying was that there was a last-minute scheduling conflict, and they pointed to Mr. Trump Jr. pulling out of another event being hosted by a podcaster, Tim Pool, in the United States around the same time. But by the time December comes around, more emails were getting sent out from organizers just saying the tour was being postponed until early 2024 and there were no other dates being organized. In my opinion, I don't think that tour is going to go ahead anytime too soon. Now, I did try and reach out to Ticketbud and the Trump Organization, but I haven't heard back from them. I guess, in my opinion, the easiest answer is that Mr. Trump's tour being delayed is because his father is campaigning in the United States.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what happens here. Blake Antrobus from News Corp Australia, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed.
Pleasure.
It is no secret that there are concerns over President Joe Biden's cognitive abilities.
America is a nation that can be defined in a single word. I was going to put him...
There's an estimation of somewhere between $700 billion and $1.3 trillion.
Over $1.3 trillion.
Los Angeles and what am I doing here?
Most recently, the 81-year-old's state of mind made headlines after the special counsel investigating his handling of classified documents wrote that no charges should be made against the president because he is, quote, an elderly man with a poor memory. During his interviews for that report, Biden reportedly forgot when he was vice president and when his son Beau had died. However, AI, artificial intelligence, has entered the chat and begs to differ when it comes to Biden's brain, specifically around these interviews he gave for the special counsel investigation. The transcripts of all of that were released, and US media outlet Business Insider decided to chuck him into ChatGPT and then another AI software, Cloud, or Claude, unsure of the pronunciation, and asked the chatbots to assess the president's cognitive abilities based on factors like clarity of thought, coherence, and memory recall. Both the AIs said he was fine. In fact, ChatGPT replied that the transcripts reflect the president is able to communicate effectively, going on to determine that the transcripts suggest he could perform cognitively demanding tasks. I don't know if that's case closed, don't know if we should let AI be the judge of that for multiple reasons, but hey, food for thought. That's Newsable for today. I'm Imogen Wells, have a good one and I'll catch you tomorrow.
If you liked listening to this pod, help us make more like this. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.